Mr. Benjamin Barrymore will argue for the appellant. Mr. David Dodge will argue for the appellate.
Okay, Mr. Barrymore.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Benjamin Barrymore, and I represent appellant Bobby Duncan. This appeal is from the trial court's granting a traditional no evidence summary judgment of Mr. Duncan's premises liability claim against his non-subscriber employer, First Texas Homes. The facts in this case are critical, and once the facts are known, it makes the argument much simpler. So with the court's indulgence, I'd like to kind of focus on the facts first. Mr. Duncan was injured while exiting an office trailer at one of the appellee's construction sites on a platform. This trailer was a manufactured housing, kind of like a mobile home, and it had an elevated door which opened outwards. In order to reach the door, appellees had stairs and a platform constructed so that it would reach up to the door. This platform was 49 and a half inches long. The door, which swung out onto the platform, was 36 inches wide. And so the clearance between the edge of the swing of the door and the edge of the platform was about 13 and a half to 14 inches. Mr. Duncan's normal method of exiting the office trailer was to go out the door, step on the platform, turn around, close, lock the door, and then turn around so he has the full 49 and a half inches to walk before going down the stairs off to wherever he needed to go.
Mr. Duncan's title was superintendent.
Yes, Your Honor.
What were his duties?
His duties as superintendent was to schedule subcontractors to complete various tasks on a residential building project and then essentially go through a checklist each day and make sure that the subcontractors are completing their task in the manner they're supposed to. Check to make sure that everything's progressing as it's supposed to progress. And that was his chief duties. Importantly, and I'm not sure if that's what the what Your Honor was directing towards, he did not have any duties to ensure safety inspections or make sure that anything was completed in a safe manner. On the day of the accident, Mr. Duncan changed his normal method of exiting the trailer. In this case, he left his work calendar out in his car. And so he only needed to leave the office for a few minutes just to go retrieve the calendar and come back to the office. So instead of turn around, closing, and locking the door, as was his custom, he instead did the very foreseeable exiting of walking onto the platform, shutting the door behind him as he was walking, and attempting to step in the clearance between the swing of the door and the edge of the platform. As I mentioned before, there's only a 14-inch clearance. Under OSHA guidelines and by the appellee's own safety manual, there's supposed to be 20 inches of clearance. And that's a safety measure to make sure that there's adequate clearance for a person to be able to shut a door and still be on the platform, or to approach a door and still be able to stay on the platform as the doors open off.
Was one of the grounds for summary judgment moved upon that Mr. Duncan had actual knowledge?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court...
The specific ground asserted in the motion for summary judgment?
It wasn't specifically really asserted. However, I did not file any special exceptions to the motion for summary judgment, and that was the principal argument during the hearing. And the trial court indicated that the reason he was granting summary judgment was because he found that Mr. Duncan had actual knowledge of the risk of harm posed by this platform's condition, and therefore, according to the trial court, that relieved the appellees of any duty to make safe the condition.
I noticed that the summary judgment that was actually granted by the trial court doesn't state any specific grounds, but you're saying that this was a specific ground that he stated on the record for granting the summary judgment?
He did not specifically state as the grounds. I actually requested that the trial court give the specific ground and proposed a judgment. He went with the broad form, so essentially I have to defend everything. However, based on the arguments and the questioning by the court, because the court asked a number of questions during the hearing, that appeared to be what he was focusing on when he was making his judgments. Yes, Your Honor. And actually, I'll go ahead and address that, because I think that's probably the key point of this summary judgment. As is the court's well aware of, when ruling on a motion for summary judgment, the trial court is supposed to indulge all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-movement. Okay. In this case, it appeared that the trial court made a finding as a matter of law that Bobby Duncan had actual knowledge of the risk of harm posed by this dangerous condition. First off, Bobby Duncan specifically testified that he did not know about the dangerous condition. And that is in the record at Clerk's Record 254. So that in itself should create a fact question. Now, the way the trial court came to this conclusion is argued by the appellees. Mr. Duncan was at this construction site for a couple years. There is no disputing that he actually walked up these stairs and used this platform hundreds of times. We're not arguing that. The difference is that he typically would be exiting the office trailer where he's turning around, closing, locking the door, and then having the full 49.5 inches to be able to walk down this platform. The condition that we're alleging posed an unreasonable risk of harm was the inadequate clearance between the swing of the door and the edge of the platform. And the normal manner that Bobby Duncan exited the trailer, that danger would not be present. It's only when he's walking out and trying to both walk and close the door behind him at the same time that becomes an issue. And the testimony is that he very, very seldom ever exited the office trailer in that manner. And that's in the clerk's record at 255. And so the evidence before the trial court was Bobby Duncan testifying that he didn't know about the danger. He very, very seldom ever used the platform in that specific manner, which is when the danger was present. And so therefore he didn't have any knowledge of it. And instead of indulging the reasonable inference that based on that evidence, Mr. Duncan did not have actual knowledge, the trial court instead determined, based on the number of times that he had used it in other capacities, that he was going to find, as a matter of law, that Bobby Duncan had actual knowledge. The second part of that is whether or not, assuming Mr. Duncan did have actual knowledge of this condition, if that relieves the appellees of their duty to take reasonable efforts to make safe the condition. Of course, the threshold question is, do they have knowledge? Robert Hernandez, who is Bobby Duncan's supervisor and the area manager for the construction project, testified that prior to this accident, he had discovered that it was dangerous on this platform when trying to enter and exit while opening and closing the door, and that he reported that danger to Bill Durham, who was the director of construction, kind of like a VP type level with the appellees. And that he was then told, well, if it meets minimum compliance, that's good enough, and then we have no testimony of any efforts taken after that to try to correct this danger.
So in effect, he said, we don't need to do anything.
In effect, yes.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. And just for your information, that testimony from Mr. Hernandez, that's at Clerk's Record 302. And the entire testimony on that area is between 301 and 309 of the Clerk's Record. And so the appellees, they had the actual knowledge that there is some kind of danger on this platform, and they refused to correct it. And they don't appear to be denying that they had knowledge, because they really can't when their employee is the one who reported it. But what they're trying to say that this somehow alleviates them from having any kind of responsibility to correct the danger. And they, at the trial court, they relied on Kroger v. Elwood, which in Kroger v. Elwood, that had to do with a Kroger employee who was unloading groceries into a customer's car, and his hand got smashed when the car door got shut on his hands. And the court determined that as an employer, they don't have to warn their employees of dangers that should be well known by the employee. Now, this is that case is distinguishable from this instance in a couple of different ways. One of the key ones is negligent activity versus premises liability. In this case, the negligence was the actual activity, sticking the hand into the customer's door, okay, versus in this case right here, where it's the premises liability based on a latent defect that's not known by the employee. In addition, the focus on the court's opinion in Elwood was what duties did the Kroger have to warn the employee that you shouldn't be sticking your hand in a car door? Or do you have to have some kind of safety equipment, I suppose gloves or something like that? And of course, the court said, no, he's well aware that you don't stick your hand in a door. We're not going to hold Kroger liable for that matter. That's a completely different set of facts in this case. A better case is Delago versus Smith, which was decided in 2010 by Texas Supreme Court.
Did you say Delago?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And I quoted the case in my briefing, but in that case, the Texas Supreme Court specifically stated that we've abolished the no-duty doctrine in Texas. Okay, we're no longer going to have it where just because an inventee has actual knowledge of a dangerous condition, that's going to alleviate the defendant of having to take reasonable efforts to correct the condition. Instead, that becomes a question for comparative negligence.
Which is inapplicable.
Your Honor?
Which is not applicable here because of First Texas being a non-subscriber.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not. And that actually goes into one of the other issues, just from a policy perspective, as far as this case goes. By allowing First Texas Homes to sit there, essentially blame the plaintiff, saying, well, he should have known better, it's his own negligence. It was his negligence not to inspect his platform, and he should have found out about this dangerous condition. They're trying to avoid the non-subscriber prohibition about using the employee's negligence as a defense from the employer's negligence. They can't do it directly, so they're trying to kind of circumvent everything. And I briefed that in my motion.
Turning briefly to your actual knowledge discussion, from reading your briefs and listening to you today, I gather that when one exited the trailer and walked straight ahead, one walked straight to the steps.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he walks out straight ahead, looking at the staircase, closes the door behind him, looking at the staircase, and then steps off onto the staircase that he's looking at into thin air.
Well,
he doesn't have actual knowledge.
Well, the problem with that's going to be is there's no evidence in the record that he's looking at the staircase. I mean, when you walk and you're going down a staircase, especially if it's your workplace, you're not necessarily staring at your feet, staring at the steps when you're walking. That's common. People don't do that necessarily. And in this case, the evidence before the trial court was simply that he was walking out the stairs, he was closing the door behind him, and then no matter where he was looking, when he stepped into air, and when he stepped into air, he fell, and he slammed his left lower back on the edge of the platform right in front of the first step. So if he had that additional 6 inches, so imagine you have 20 inches, if he had the 20 inches, he would have stepped in that this extra 6 inches past the 14 inches. Because those 6 inches weren't there, his foot stepped in the air where he thought there would be platform, and that's what caused him to fall. And as far as the actual knowledge goes, I think the actual knowledge goes into if you have prior knowledge of the condition, not necessarily at the exact instance when, you know, he's stepping. This positive question isn't, okay, was he staring out there and stepped purposely into air? I'm thinking he'd be the sole proximate cause if that's what he did. But there's no evidence that that's what happened in the case. You know, his case was just that he was walking and he thought there was platform, and when he stepped, there was air. And the reason there was air was because First Texas Homes had a platform that did not meet their own safety guidelines, that did not meet the safety guidelines of OSHA, and simply just from a common sense standpoint, did not provide sufficient space for a person to be able to close a door while still walking on the platform. And I believe there's enough evidence in the record for there to be a fact question on all the elements, so that that should go to a jury to decide whether or not First Texas is negligent and whether they had knowledge of the condition and whether or not that was the proximate cause of the defendant's injuries. It shouldn't have been granted, or it shouldn't have been decided by summary judgment at the trial court level.
Was sole proximate cause raised as a ground for the motion for summary judgment? Excuse me.
Yes, it wasn't real strongly briefed by the appellees. It was in there. And I respect my time's up, but just in the last point, I did address, of course, sole proximate cause. They're trying to say that he was his sole proximate cause because of the way he was exiting that day, that is somehow unreasonably dangerous for him to be walking while closing a door behind him. Frankly, I think that's a fact question because people walk like that all the time. When I exit platforms, I'm not always turning around, closing and locking the door. I'm typically walking and closing the door behind me while I walk. And so that should be something for a jury to decide as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your time's up, but you'll have time for rebuttal. Okay, we'll hear from the appellee.
Good afternoon. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is David Dodge. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, First Texas Homes. There's more in my brief, but I want to cover three main points today and then address some of the questions that were directed to appellant's counsel as well. The three main points I want to cover are the absence of unreasonable risk of harm, the lack of causation here, and also the absence of any duty to warn. Texas law recognizes that not every injury is the result of negligence. Accidents happen. It's just a fact. That's why the Texas Supreme Court has repeatedly held that an employer is not an insurer of an employee's safety at work. The employer's duty is to provide a reasonably safe working environment. What the appellants would have this court do is rule that an employer has an obligation to provide a perfectly safe working environment, regardless of the negligence of the employee himself, even if in the case of a sole proximate cause. The stairs here presented no unreasonable risk of harm as a matter of law. The law is clear. If an employee's injury arises from the same character of work as other employees have performed without incident, the employer is not liable for the employee's injury unless the work was unusually hazardous. Walking up and down these stairs was not unusually hazardous. How do we know that? Because the plaintiff did it over 2,200 times without incident. There was also no evidence that anyone else ever had a problem traversing these stairs. 4 times per day, 5 days per week, for 2 years and 3 months, the plaintiff crossed these stairs back and forth with no problem whatsoever.
What about the company's own safety handbook provision that required the platform to be about, 6 inches longer?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question, and it feeds into, that mirrors this OSHA regulation that the plaintiffs have focused on here, or the appellants have focused on here.
Were both of those part of the summary judgment record, copies of both?
Yes, okay. I believe that they were, or at least excerpts of that, of the manual that you're referencing. First of all, we have an issue as to whether the OSHA part that's referenced by the plaintiff applies here at all, and that's briefed at, I believe, page 13 of our brief. But the issue of whether OSHA or the manual was complied with is not an issue as to whether there was an unreasonable risk of harm. If you look at the McDaniel case, which I believe is cited on page 11 of our brief, that case holds that if there's some sort of building code violation or code violation, which is essentially the equivalent of what the safety manual violation is, that it doesn't go to the unreasonable risk of harm element. It only goes to the element of the failure to reduce or eliminate an unreasonable risk of harm that already is shown to exist. There is no unreasonable risk of harm that's been shown to exist in this case because of the use, extensive, repeated, uneventful use of these stairs by the plaintiff himself, among many others. So, in other words, an alleged noncompliance with OSHA or alleged noncompliance with the similar requirement in the safety manual is not the equivalent of creating an unreasonable risk of harm. It's not even evidence of a reasonable risk of harm under the McDaniel case. And that's a 1994 case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals. So the second point I wanted to raise is there's also no causal connection between any alleged OSHA violation or deviation from this manual and the plaintiff's alleged injury. The appellate claims that the use of the stairs on the day of the incident was unusual, that he did it differently. But the appellant's alleged manner of use didn't change the size of the landing, and that's to your point, Justice McCoy. Walking straight out the door, facing the stairs, walking straight down the stairs, looking at the stairs, he still had the same 50 inches of clearance to walk on as he did if he turned around, shut the door, and turned around and walked down the stairs. It's the same, with the door open, exact same space. The landing was also the same size it was all the other times he covered it and traversed it without any problem whatsoever. Nothing about the stairs had changed. There's no causal connection between this alleged deviation from OSHA or alleged deviation from the manual and the plaintiff's injuries here. Now, appellant's counsel says, well, you know, Elwood's different somehow because it's a negligent activity case. There, the negligent activity was the negligent activity of the employee sticking his hand in the car door. What the employee alleged, how the employee alleged that Kroger was negligent in this case, in that particular case, was that it had failed to warn the employee not to put his hand in the door. Here, the argument is essentially, you failed to warn me not to step off the steps, even though I traversed them that thousands of times before.
Well, isn't it also failure to provide a safe place to work?
No, Your Honor, that's the unreasonable risk of harm issue. If there's no unreasonable risk of harm, then it is a reasonably safe place to work. And that's what we're saying here. And that's, if you look at the trial court's transcript, and contrary to the suggestion in appellant's briefing, this is a broad form summary judgment granted motion or order, so anything in the record that will support summary judgment is a basis for affirming something.
Well, if it's properly raised in the trial court, in the motion or response.
Yes, I agree. But if you look at the transcript, essentially what the trial court said is, look, accidents happen. You know, sometimes people fall down, and it's nobody's fault. And that was really the logic, is there's no unreasonable risk of harm here. How could there be? When everybody had used these stairs perfectly safely all these times, and then all of a sudden, this one time, somebody falls, and therefore, all of a sudden, these stairs are unreasonably dangerous? Trial court didn't find that. There's no evidence of it.
So, because going back a minute ago to what you said about he had traversed the stairs platform thousands of times over a two-year period, because there's evidence of that in support of the summary judgment, we disregard OSHA and the company's own handbook, safety handbook.
Those aren't relevant to the unreasonable risk of harm element. If you look at the McDaniel case, which dealt with building codes, and what that case said is it's only relevant to, once you've established unreasonable risk of harm, did you take reasonable steps to mitigate or eliminate? That's what the deviation from OSHA or deviation from building codes or deviation from manual is. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Interrupt you. What about the testimony of Mr. Hernandez that he told, was it Durbin?
Mr. Durham, I believe, is the gentleman's name. If you look at
dangerous.
That testimony, and I would encourage you all to do so, what Mr. Hernandez was told by Mr. Durham is, if we are in compliance, there's nothing that needs to be done. Well, they were in compliance with the relevant and applicable building code. And that's the section of the International Residential Code that only requires a landing to be 36 inches long. Now, in their reply, the appellants have challenged compliance, that evidence of compliance. But that was not a challenge that was raised below. It's therefore waived. Further, even if it were not waived, it's an issue that is a matter of, that can be decided as a matter of law. The residential code says what it says, and the fact that the landing was 50 inches long is undisputed. So it's longer than 36 inches, and therefore it complied with the International Residential Code. And the chief building inspector for the city of Frisco, who's been on the job for 24 years, supports that, the applicability of that code to this trailer. Now, we've also put in the record, or in our briefing, case law that shows that the part of OSHA on which the plaintiffs are relying is inapplicable here. And that's the Cole versus Neighbors Drilling case out of the Southern District of Mississippi. And the reason it's inapplicable here is because there's no evidence of any federal funding of this particular construction project, and that was the basis on which the Cole case decided that it was inapplicable, and where the employee in that case fell down the stairs and tried to use the same regulation as a basis for showing an unreasonable risk of harm. The third point I did want to cover was that absence of any duty to warn, and this is the issue that goes to the appellant's actual knowledge of the condition of the stairs. If there was some unreasonable risk of harm because of the length of the stair or the landing, nobody knew that better than the appellant. Nobody. He went up and down those stairs day after day after day. No problems, but if it was suddenly dangerous, then he knew about it. Now, why is that important? It's because the non-subscription case law says that if an employee is aware of the hazards of employment, there is no duty on the part of the employer to further warn him about that.
But that wasn't a hazard of employment. Going up and down the stairs wasn't, that didn't have anything to do with his job description.
But it did, because his place of work was in that trailer. He was the lead person, the top management person on site, on the construction site, day in and day out. His office was that trailer. So getting to work involved him walking up and down those stairs every day. And he had actual knowledge, not only because he walked up and down the stairs every day, but also because he inspected and signed off on the original construction of the stairs. He used them thousands of times without incident, and he knew how long that landing was.
How do we know that? What's in the record that shows that?
Well, the very fact that he used them thousands of times tells you he knew what the distance was. And I believe even appellant's counsel made reference to the fact that if you're going to work every day and you're going traversing the same area every day, you become familiar with that area. So under the Kroger versus Elwood case, there's no duty to warn of hazards already known or appreciated by the employee. So if the distance here is some sort of unreasonable risk of harm, then the appellant knew about it and there was no duty to warn. And I think there's some confusion in the analysis presented by the appellant with respect to the difference between no duty to warn and what's relevant to that element, and then whether it is whether there was actual breach of the duty. So I believe that what the actual knowledge goes to is whether, in the non-subscriber context, is whether there's a duty to warn at all, and there is none here.
So Del Lago is not relevant?
I believe it's distinguishable.
Or distinguishable?
Yes, ma'am. It's not a non-subscriber case. It's a case where there was a bar fight at the Del Lago resort down in Austin, continued to escalate, and the people who got involved and got punched out said, hey, you should have had security here. It was apparent that this was becoming a problem. Here, you're dealing with a non-subscriber case. And this law that's stated in Elwood and carried down from Werner and has been reiterated even after Del Lago is intact in this context. There's no duty to warn if the employee is aware of some hazardous condition. And if there is, in fact, some hazardous condition here, there's nobody who was more aware of it than an appellant.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you agree that the actual knowledge has cannot form a basis for granting the no evidence summary judgment?
Are you asking me whether it's essentially an affirmative defense?
Yes. Basically, I'm saying I don't think that the plaintiff has the burden of proof on that, and if they do have the burden of proof, they met it by putting in an affidavit that they didn't have actual notice of the defect or of the unreasonably dangerous condition. So at least as to the no evidence summary judgment, that cannot be a basis for granting a no evidence summary judgment in your favor.
I understand your question. It is an element of their cause of action to prove duty to warn, and to the extent that the actual knowledge is relevant to the issue of there is no duty to warn if you're aware of the hazard, then I don't think it's our burden to put that in. Now, traditional motion for summary judgment, we make that showing as a matter of law, and I think we have. So.
So the no duty doctrine, the Supreme Court says, was abolished as to open and obvious dangers known to the invitee, but that doesn't apply to employees?
I don't believe it applies in the non-subscription context, because even after DeLago, you've got cases in the non-subscription context that are holding the same thing and following Elwood and its progeny. And predecessor cases as well.
What do we do about the employee's affidavit in the context of the traditional motion for summary judgment? Does it not, the employee's affidavit that he did not know of the danger?
I'm not familiar with the affidavit you're referring to.
Okay. I thought, or testimony. Was it deposition?
It may have been deposition testimony. I think what he said was he was not aware that it was a dangerous condition, not that he wasn't aware of the length of the platform. And I think that fits right in with our argument that there was no unreasonably dangerous condition. So it supports the lack of the appellant's cause of action and the granting of summary judgment. Are there any other questions I can answer? It looks like I'm well out of time.
More. Well, thank you very much for your argument. Thank you, Mr. Barrymore. We appreciate it. No, you have a rebuttal. I'm sorry. Please proceed.
Briefly. Council focused very much on whether or not the condition posed an unreasonable risk of harm. A condition poses a risk of harm when there is sufficient probability of a harmful event occurring that a reasonably prudent person would have foreseen it or some similar event is likely to happen. Okay, and that's Sedenick versus Cal Beruther Associates, Texas Supreme Court, 1970. In the evidence, Robert Hernandez, the area manager, told Bill Durham that there was not enough room on the platform to maneuver safely when opening and closing the door while getting on and off the platform. That's a clerk's record 302. Okay, so their own employees, Appellee's own employees, was able to foresee that someone may get hurt based on the condition of the platform. In addition, you have the OSHA regulations and the Appellee's own safety manual putting forth specific safety standards on the amount of distance you have between the swing and door and the edge of the platform. That in itself should be some evidence that it's foreseeable that a person could be injured if there's inadequate clearance. Now, whether the risk of harm is unreasonable then depends on the risk and likelihood of injury to plaintiff and the magnitude and consequences of placing a duty on the defendant. And that's DeLago Partners at 770. Unreasonable tends to be a fact question for a jury. In this particular case, it's the risk and likelihood of injury. So what's the risk of somebody falling down the stairs because you don't have enough room? And you have to evaluate that versus the consequences of placing the duty on the defendant, in this case to repair, correct the condition, which is to make sure that the platform is 6 inches longer. We're talking probably one board, and it would just require them to comply with OSHA and their own safety regulations. So they have minimal burden on the defendant, but the potential risk of harm to someone falling down these stairs, as evidenced based on the injuries to my client, shows that you have a high magnitude of potential harm. And so just breaking down what you're required to show for unreasonable risk of harm, there is evidence of unreasonable, that the condition posed unreasonable risk of harm in this case. Counsel also argued extensively as saying that because Bobby Duncan worked at this place for 2 years and 3 months, that he's familiar with the workplace, therefore he should have constructive knowledge of all the dangerous conditions on the platform or on the work site, just by virtue of his familiarity with it. The problem with that analysis is it truly does go into a slippery slope, because you can't hold a person, anybody, liable for a premises liability condition if the condition was there so briefly that they had no opportunity to be able to discover it. And so you have to have the condition long enough for you to have an opportunity to discover it. But based on their logic, if the condition lasted long enough for them to have discovered it, the employee knows about it. And so therefore, they're never going to have a duty to warn the employee or to make safe the condition. And employees will never be able to hold their employers accountable for failing to provide safe work environments because of dangerous conditions. It just eliminates any kind of possible hole you could have in there. Counsel also pointed out that the trial court indicated that accidents sometimes just happen. Sometimes people just fall, and that, you know, based on the number of times that Mr. Duncan had used these stairs, he believed that they were safe and that the accident just happens. That's a factual determination. That's something that should have been found by a jury, not by the trial court on summary judgment when there's clearly evidence contrary to that. Counsel also focused on the size of the platform didn't change. Just on the manner he was walking didn't change the size of the platform. You're right. The size of the platform doesn't change. What changes, though, is how the platform is being used. If you're closing the door and you're walking, you have 49.5 inches to walk. Okay, by any measure, if you have 4 feet of platform, that's going to be safe. However, if you're using the foreseeable method of exiting while walking and closing the door, well, now you only have that 14 inches of clearance. That's dangerous condition. The dangerous condition isn't the 49.5 inches of platform. The dangerous condition is that there's only 14 inches between the swing of the door and the edge of the platform.
I'm not following that. You're walking straight ahead 49 or 50 inches, whether you're closing the door behind you or not.
And actually, that may help. The way this platform is constructed is you have room on the side so that if you're exiting and closing the door, you can step out to the side, close the door, and you're standing right here to lock the door, and then turn around and walk.
Right.
Okay? And so in his general manner, when he's walking to the side, he's turning around and closing, well, now you have 4 feet. You have plenty of room to be able to walk safely, be able to see where you're going.
Okay.
Versus when you're sitting there and you're closing the door behind you and you're just doing whatever, normal biomechanics is you get trained to walk a certain way. Okay, you get trained to expect to be able to have one step at least past that door while you're closing it behind you. In this case, the way these stairs were constructed, you would have to step onto that first step while closing the door behind you. Okay, that's not how people expect to walk. That's how come OSHA sets regulations so that there is common, everything's constructed in a way so people can walk without having to always be looking at their feet. Okay, in this case, Mr. Duncan didn't realize that he'd have to be stepping on that first step in order to be able to have enough room to close the door behind him. He thought he'd have that extra step, and he didn't.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
appreciate your argument, Mr. Barrymore, Mr. Dodge, and Mr. Evans. Is that correct? Thank you. Your case is submitted.